Good afternoon and welcome to today's meeting at the Commonwealth Club of California and the Bay Gourmet Forum, exploring the origin of the modern cookbook with Ann Willen, author of the Cookbook Library, Four Centuries of the Cooks, Writers, and Recipes That Make the Modern Cookbook. I'm Kathy Curtis, chair of the Bay Gourmet Forum. Special thanks to the Bernard Osher Foundation for underwriting the Good Lit and Food Lit series at the Commonwealth Club. And you can find more about the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. It's my great pleasure to introduce Ann Willen, cookbook author, cooking instructor, and food historian. Ann has written over a dozen internationally published cookbooks, including The Country Cooking of France, Ann Willen's The Good Cook from My Chateau Kitchen, which introduces readers to life in Burgundy, and to Anne's cooking at Chateau du Fay. Other well-known books include Cooking with Wine, the influential La Varine Pratique, and the profusely illustrated step-by-step Look and Cook series in 17 volumes. Anne's international outreach, with books published in 24 countries and translated into 18 languages, make her one of the most internationally renowned of today's cooking authorities. In her latest book, she traces the development of recipes over time and updates those recipes for the modern kitchen. Anne's talk today is entitled The Cookbook Tree of Life, which explores genre development in early cookbooks. Please help me in welcoming Ann Willen.
Many thanks to Kathy and to all of you for coming this morning, and above all to California Press, who have been wonderful, wonderful to work with on what has been at least a 10-year project and kind of a 40-year project, collecting increasingly old and antiquarian cookbooks. I and my husband. And just recently it occurred to me that, of course, all books, but certainly all cookbooks, have roots. They come from somewhere. And I was thinking, well, one way of looking at it is just like a family tree. And so we've constructed this family tree, which kind of sums up what is explored in much more depth in the cookbook library, all sorts of aspects of cookbooks, who wrote them, who read them, who ate the food, and quite a lot of the background and sociological aspects of cookbooks. The images that we're going to see are almost all from our cookbook collection, excluding a few of the very earliest. And one of the things that I enormously enjoyed when I started doing the research for this, for the cookbook library, is the first four cookbooks. There are four early cookbooks that are incunabula, that date back to before 1501, and they come from four different countries and written in four different languages, which means, and of course, I'm talking only about European cookbooks. And the fascinating thing is that throughout Europe, therefore, there was sufficient interest in cooking and food that of the possibly 700 printed books that appeared before 1501, four of them were cookbooks. And the first one is by Platina, the Vatican librarian, published in Rome, and it's kind of a diet and health book. And one of the things he says is, sex is wiser in the evening than the afternoon. But the book is a cookbook. It's mainly recipes. This is an early 16th century printing. The next, 10 years later, is Kuchenmeisterei, German. Neither of these books, of course, are enormously large and important, but they both had around 200 recipes, and this is the charming illustration from the 1490 edition. It was printed in Nuremberg, and what a nice picture, very early illustration, a woodcut of what's going on in the kitchen. And so one does get a vivid feeling for, I mean, it was a pretty simple place. This is how people were eating. This is 1491, a woodcut from our collection, a print, actually, that we have. And feasting was done on trestle tables. You can see the high table, the prince. Nobody actually knows who he is. Let me press my little... There he is. But he's got a crown. He's eating classically with a trencher, that is slices of bread that were tranché, sliced, no plates. And that's his salt cellar for seasoning. Here's the guy who's slicing the bread. And here's his wine keeping cool in some water at his feet. They've turned him round. He would be facing his guests just so that we can see him. This is representative of the third book in French, commissioned, in fact, in the 1370s by King Charles V of France. Kuchenmeisterei, by the way, not sure who commissioned the book, but possibly a wealthy group of burghers, or possibly a religious foundation. But people who were financing books at the time were very, very rich. Cost a lot of money. This is Taillevent's tomb. Taillevent was the cook to Charles V in the 14th century, and it was already a book that was much copied in manuscript form, and this is Taillevent's tomb. And here is just it's from the Luttrell Psalter in England, and just to show again kind of what life was like in the kitchen and once the food got out to the dining room. Then moving back to the tree. Just to explain kind of what I'm getting at here. Here we have the four first early books in the 15th century. They come from, of course, all of them, early manuscripts. And then moving to the 16th century, you can see the branches, and this main trunk is the important general books, the branches, and starting in Italy, what I call beautiful books. they epitomize the High Renaissance. This is Messis Bougot, 1547. This is his outdoor kitchen. A lot of cooking was done, of course, out of doors. And you can see everything that was at the cook's disposal. And the people who were involved in getting the food to the table. The smaller the figures in these early illustrations, the less their importance. So the poor little guy who is operating the bellows was not important, and the cook himself is kind of the largest and most prominent figure, as is the guy rolling pasta. There's a small group of really lovely Italian books. Messis Bougot was working for the Este family, and this is Domenico Rimoli, who Rimoli was working for cardinals, and I don't think a pope, but for a cardinal, and he is the first person really to write a menu book. He has a lot of recipes as well, but he's unique for many centuries in writing down what his master ate at every meal for a whole year. So the date is, the year is 1546. The book was printed in 1560, but you can read what he ate for breakfast and lunch and dinner, not just for parties, which is very interesting. I mean, there were a lot of fruits and vegetables and just kind of simple stuff. And it's not as beautiful, or it doesn't have such beautiful illustrations as Messis Bougot, but this is a pretty nice frontispiece. Now, this is one of the most famous cookbooks, certainly of the early cookbooks. Has anybody seen this before? It's often illustrated. Scarpi, and this Scarpi is famous for all sorts of things, as far as I'm concerned as a cook, because it was a really comprehensive cookbook. He has over 1,000 recipes. It's in wonderful italic script, which you can see in the little titles running here. He has menus. He has seasonal ideas and talks about the products that you should be using. The best ducks come from a certain province at a certain time of year. He worked for 2 cardinals and the Pope. And then at the back, he is the most famous for 14 pages of illustration of basically what one would call an ideal kitchen. And he shows pages of knives, of pots and pans, and this is his kitchen that he would love to have had. He would have had some of it, but I very much doubt if he had all of it, because here, and you still see the same things in the kitchen today, and certainly this sort of kitchen would have continued for 3 centuries after Scarpi. Here's mortar and pestle on a stone column, looking exactly the same today. Here is pasta being rolled. There's the fluted pasta cutter. Everyone wants running water in the kitchen. He has a nice screen, the little guy who's turning the spit, who's waving to us. a screen so he doesn't get too hot. Above is the cauldron. The proportions are slightly out on a whole lot of things. Here, this would be, I think, a rabbit skin, probably. Here are hams hanging to smoke. Light, because, of course, after dark, you had to rely on the flames of the fire to illuminate the kitchen. One doesn't think of things like that. It's called the principal kitchen. He also illustrates a cold kitchen and a dairy and the outside where they're butchering the animals and sharpening the knives. And there's a great big tub of fish swimming in water. Here, that's a bale of straw where you stick your knives so that they don't do any damage. This is the bread up on a high shelf so that the dogs don't get it. And here is one of the earliest illustrations of a raised stove. Now, we take for granted cooking at kind of waist height. But until pretty well Scarpi, 1570, you were cooking over an open fire, either in a cauldron with a spit or with a long-handled frying pan. So that really restricted the kind of dishes that you could make. Whereas once you had a charcoal-fired series of pots, just like today's casseroles, you could do more refined sauces, you could control the cooking time of things like pasta. It was a whole new revolution. But stoves like this didn't appear in even middle-level households for at least two centuries. Only the very wealthy, and beginning in Italy, but spreading north to France and up into England, I don't know much about Germany, you didn't get closed stoves often until the 18th century. So returning to the tree, and moving on, looking at other genres that did very well at this time, carving, charming books on carving, which was one of the talents of a gentleman should be able to display. So you never left things on a carving board. You lifted them with your hands. Let's go to the next one. There we are, you see. You held things on the fork and you carved it in front of people. It was all part of the entertainment at a sophisticated feast. And there are wonderful books, not very many, three or four, but one of the great advantages was that they could be understood in any language because they're pictorial. And they show the lines for cutting, and so they were some of the first international cookbooks. Then this, I'm irresistibly reminded of my husband, Mark Chernievsky, who helped write the book, but collected the books that form our collection, and he has spent quite a lot of was certainly his favorite moments in his library, surrounded by the books and immersed in the books. Some people here are the same. Yeah. This is from one of the first general books. That's to say, books that try to teach you a little bit, Scarpi was sort of into it, but a little bit about everything that goes on in the kitchen. So garde-manger, baking, not bread baking, but pastry, meat cookery, fish cookery. And, of course, it's a genre that, not surprisingly, is early established and has flourished ever since. This is a wonderfully illustrated book by a guy called Rumpolt, and it's a lobster, and you can see a poor man in the clutches of the lobster's claw. It's symbolic of I'm not quite sure what, because the lobster was the enemy of the serpent. And the serpent, of course, is also the enemy of man. So quite why the lobster has got a man in his claw, perhaps he's saving him from a serpent somewhere. Not sure. But there are many illustrations in Rumpold of this quality. And very northern and Flemish and Germanic, very different from the Italian tradition. Here's England. This is a great big book. Rumpold is quite big too. This is the famous English Gerard's Herbal. And this is the frontispiece. And it's a big book. I mean, it's about this leather-bound, the copy we have, which I think is from 1530, and thick. And every page has an illustration of some plant or other that's used in medicine or used in cooking. And you will have seen Gerard's herbal illustrations, probably without realizing what they were. They were gathered from all over Europe and are much, much reproduced. So returning to the tree, one or two others, just quickly to mention their names, that date from the 16th century. Big books on agriculture in all languages. And all countries, of course. I can't read what that is. But coming over to here, international cookbooks, or rather books that mention international recipes. So they'll say a la Catalana or Parisienne. But clearly the cooks that wrote them, even here, were travelling all over Europe and cooking in different places. Over here, we have little books, which were rather an English specialty, little bit like paperbacks nowadays, quite small. Very few have survived because they were so fragile. They were cheap, relatively speaking, and intended for use. There are early gardening books telling you how to grow your vegetables. And a genre that has continued, but not obviously, which is books of secrets. Secrets were a genre that flourished in the 16th and 17th century. People had treasured possessions. It might be books, they might be embroidery. The secrets really meant that they were looked after and cherished and prized, and gentlemen had books of secrets, and books of secrets often included things about cooking and recipes. And quite soon we're going to see the first books that aimed for women. Now, the very first ones were not written by women. This is Gervase Markham, Sir Gervase Markham, noted for one of the first recipes for baking bread. Bread baking recipes came very late. And Jervis Markham was, however, writing for households, and it clearly shows the rise in England and that would have been in parallel in Germany, the rise of a prosperous middle class. Now, that meant two things which have had a huge influence on the number of cookbooks, what cookbooks contained. One was literacy. For most early cookbooks, and even at this date, where here was 1664, cooks would not have been literate. It was a manual skill, it was an administrative skill, but cooks, you could not have relied on the cook in the kitchen being able to read and write. The other enormous influence on cookbooks was the rise of the middle class. People with enough money to be educated, to learn to read and write, but also to be able to afford to buy just a few books. And one of the first books that you probably would want if you had, 10 people in the household would have been a cookbook. And the cookbook would have contained culinary recipes, medical recipes, and just general household hints. This is the Countess of Kent. It was written probably, she's Elizabeth Grey. This is the 15th edition, and it's 1667, there we are. It's one of the first portraits of a woman in a book. I always hate to say first, because then somebody always puts their hand up. And it's a tiny little book. It's only about 3 inches by 5 inches, and it's made, it's, you can see our copy, isn't, though it's in better condition than it looks there. Made to slip in your pocket, carry around with you, which shows that the cookbooks would have been getting into the kitchen. Now, this is the first cookbook written by a woman for women. Hannah Woolley, who was a career woman, she ran a cooking school, she ran catering business, and her book clearly is derived from what we call her commonplace book. That's to say, the collection of useful things that she kept in a book that were probably written out by hand or little scraps of paper collected from friends. And here, she's really, it's very disorganized, the book. You have all sorts of things, one following another. And she just got the printer to print her commonplace book. She's the author of several books, and it started a flourishing genre in England, which has remained very much an English specialty, domestic household books. Now, half a dozen English books were brought, more than half a dozen, I mean, half a dozen books by half a dozen different authors, cookbooks, were brought over here with the early colonists, and half a dozen were reprinted over here, all on the East Coast, of course. But it wasn't until 1796 that actually an original American book was written and printed. And that's American cookery that any of you who are interested in the history of cookbooks will know. Amelia Simmons. This is, we only have a facsimile of the first edition. in a Hartford. It wouldn't have been printed in very many copies. I've no idea, but let's say 200. Then it was printed over the next 20 years, reprinted in various different places, because early America, each of the moderate-sized towns, or even the big town cities, Philadelphia, Boston, New York, I can't remember, possibly Richmond, would have had single, probably not more, printing presses and printed news sheets, broadsides, and just a few books. So it's not like sort of the huge runs that one thinks of today. Amelia Simmons is, in comparison with the English books of the time, really quite simple. The recipes are often only two or three lines. There are quite a lot of them. There are 200. They sort of compare, with the first English book of 1500. It took a little while, but not all that long, for America to catch up with contemporary English cookbooks. And they took a rather different line. They wrote regional books, books for New England, books for Virginia, books for the South, Louisiana, because, of course, the ingredients, the climate, and just the general tastes of the settlers were very different in different places. So you wanted different cookbooks. The other thing that the very first American cookbook kind of inspired were books by women. Lydia Maria Child and the kind of women's movement genre that developed in the mid-19th century. So back we go to the 18th century. We've done the counties of Kent. And moving to France. By now, by the mid-19th century, we get the first classic French cookbook, La Varenne, for which we named our cooking school in Paris that we launched in 1975, a general cookbook. We have compilations of books for stewards, books for cooks. We have books on catering. We have books for maitre d'hôtel. We have specialty cookbooks, ingredient cookbooks. There's a lovely little run of books, just four or five of them, on coffee, tea, and chocolate, the new drinks that came in the late 17th century. And here's, I think this is going to be our next illustration. Well, we're going to look at Cuisinier François, which is what I was talking about in La Varenne. Specialty. This is sugar, confectionery. Confectionery became a recognized genre. Actually, this illustration comes from a book on gardening, but never mind. And here you can see the women in the kitchen all having a lovely time. They're not professional cooks. These are nice ladies getting together for an afternoon of making sweets and comfits and cookies and lovely sweet delights, because sugar had become cheaper and cheaper and therefore used much more. He's the Chinese guy drinking tea. and he's one of three illustrations from one of these books on coffee, tea, and chocolate. Isn't he nice? And this, it's got to be French, hasn't it? The Cupids. You see this illustration often. The Cupids are making ices. And ices was a big, big fad that started with chilled drinks in Turkey, Sharbar, where the name comes for sherbet, sorbet, and then was picked up in Naples in southern Italy because of the perpetual snows of Etna, and then moved north rapidly, and that these little huts are ice houses where you stored great blocks of ice so that in the summer you could have chilled drinks, and then later it became chilled, solid fromage, they were called, made with the traditional ice buckets and ice and salt. It's nice, isn't it? I can see you smiling. Here we're moving along to really a very different genre. Let me move on from ices. Now we're into the 18th century, and we've seen quite a lot of classic French books on cooking, on gardening, on all of the things that surround the kitchen. And by the mid-18th century, arrived a famous chef, and he is the first to use the word chef for the senior cook in the kitchen. Late, 1755, I think it is, Manon. He's usually given the first name François Manon, but Manon is the only certain name he's known by. He cooked at the court of Louis XV, and he was the first to write a book with a nicely ambiguous title, La Cuisinière Bourgeoise, which could mean the bourgeois female cook or could refer to cuisine, which is feminine and therefore is about bourgeois cooking. So, but that was the very first book written kind of with women cooks in mind in France. But it's not noticeably different like the British genre or the English genre of household cookbooks. Then back to the tree, and England in the 18th century. We have Dear Hannah Glass. She was much... Oh, no, we don't have Dear Hannah Glass. She's next, is she? Okay. In England, we have professional chefs who were always men. Cooking, of course, at this date and continued to be in the great kitchens, enormously physical and tough work. And there were a series of Englishmen who often were trained in France and wrote cookbooks, and they were writing books about these sort of feasts. This is just one of remove of at least a three-course meal, and each of these is a different dish. So if one counts these, and I have to say I haven't, let's say there are a couple of dozen dishes, that indicates two dozen guests. Because if you were a sophisticated chef who wanted to honor your master, you offered a different dish for the number of guests. And this led to the huge feasts at the turn of the century, the Tsar of Russia, the Prince Regent, the Congress of Vienna, where 100 or more different dishes were served under Carême, who I'll come to in a minute, reflecting 100 guests. Yes, so it means 300 different dishes. I mean, the mind boggles even nowadays. But there are a whole lot of, not a lot of menus of that length, but a sufficient number that one assumes that they were actually followed. So there was this masculine tradition in England and indeed in France of men working with, it would be almost all men, in the kitchen, and women, and Hannah Glass wrote this wonderful cookbook, which is immensely readable, and she said there was great rivalry between France and England at the time. It's 1747, and she said, "Such is the blind folly of this age that they would rather be imposed on by a French booby than give encouragement to a good English cook." So there was very definitely, by then, a recognized different English tradition of cookery. And it traces right back to the roots and Book of Cookery in 1500. Simpler cooking, great emphasis on roasts and accompaniments to the roasts, to relishes and sauces and vegetable dishes on the side, but not that great complex depth of flavors that you find in French dishes. Hannah was a career woman, as you could see, and that is the frontispiece to one edition of the fourth edition of Art of Cookery Made Plain and Easy. And she was therefore by appointment to the Princess of Wales. So she'd really developed things. The Art of Cookery, by the way, went to 21 editions and it remained in print for at least 70 years. And now we're coming to the 19th century, and really clearly leading into today and the cookbook genre that we recognize today. We have gastronomic commentators. Grimaud La Reynière, who was the first to write a gastronomic almanac. It went to 11 years. This is a frontispiece from one of the years. And here is the gastronome with a nice little paunch congratulating the chef. And Grimaud says that the first duty of a gastronome is to think of the chef and to thank the chef. Now, this is enormous fun. This is a Cruikshank cartoon, 1791. This is Louis the Sixth. 16th, it is, isn't it? On court at Varennes on his escape from Paris. And he lingered, tradition has it, over his dinner. They'd stopped for dinner. Here's his chicken. And here's the guy who's come to arrest him. And you have the Dauphin, who's grizzling away in the background, and Louis doesn't want to move and look at the amount of wine he's already consumed. and here's Marie Antoinette preening herself in the mirror. That's nice, isn't it? So there were gastronomic commentators. There were restaurant cookbooks. What we were seeing then, sorry, can we just flip that? What we're seeing here is not a restaurant, it's an inn. And of course, inns had provided food for travelers for many centuries. Restaurants first appeared in the late 18th century. They're really quite late. And the first restaurant cookbook came out in the early 1800s. Sorry, so I mean late. I'm getting in a muddle with my centuries. Anyway, by a guy called Beauvillier, who had one of the very first restaurants in Paris. Another of the genre that came really very late is regional cooking, and an interest in regional cooking, particularly in France. This is the very first gastronomic map. It dates from 1809, but there weren't really books about regional cooking until the motor car and Michelin, who wanted people to drive around France and wear out their tires. Here's Karen, who I was talking about, who is the archetypal and sort of the first celebrity chef. He drew this. He was a master draftsman. He cooked, as I said, for the Tsar of Russia. He cooked through the Revolution and on into the Restoration. He cooked for the Tsar of Russia, for the Prince Regent, for Talleyrand at the Congress of Vienna. He left half a dozen classic cookbooks. And here he is with the old cook, with the nightcap, which is the beginning of the chef's hat. And here is the beginning of the toque that we know, which is the nightcap with a circle of carton in the cap to keep it cooler on the head. Shorter, more practical apron, very trendy boots. I mean, you could wear those nowadays and no trouble at all. And the classic chef's jacket is exactly the same. Washable buttons, loose sleeves, that you can turn up. So if you want to, put your arm over a pot, a knife kit, the torchon in the apron, nothing has changed at all. And that's one of the things that I find utterly fascinating about old books. Where do they come from? Where are they leading? And all of these genres you'll see in the tree are going to lead and into our modern books, 20th century books, all books, whatever the kind, not just cookbooks, have a pedigree. And I describe the pedigree of cookbooks in great detail in the cookbook library. We've time for a few questions and a microphone. Someone like to come up to the mic? Yes. Who collects cookbooks? Oh, good.
First of all, I'd like to thank you very, very much for this fascinating lecture. It was very illuminating. And
thank you.
Entertaining and educational. My question is, how did you become interested in collecting cookbooks, in cooking, in starting a cooking school, etc.? Thank you.
Goodness, I'll try to be very brief. I got interested in cooking because I loved to eat. And as a tiny child, I was notorious for being greedy. I got into cookbook collecting because my husband, new husband at the time, said, "Anne, if you're going to write about cookbooks, you've got to have some cookbooks." And we started collecting used books. And then, as I've been talking about all the time, once you have a few books, you want some more. And the school, I was convinced, and it's less true now, but it certainly was in the early 1970s, that the place to go to learn the scales and the music of cooking is to go to France. And anywhere else, particularly for learning the techniques and, all of the theory and the practice and the excitement and just good eating. The French are very good at it.
Did you know Julia Child?
Very well indeed. I knew Julia, for something until she died. But I first met Julia just before our daughter was born, which is 40 years ago. Yes.
I agree. What a fascinating presentation. Thank you.
Thank you.
Where can an average person have accessibility to any of these books? Do you know of any sources, either here or in Europe, where one can go to peruse these kinds of books?
Well, more and more on the Internet. I can't offhand give you addresses on the Internet to go to, but the great holdings of cookbooks are usually in public libraries, very often in university libraries. The Library of Congress has a wonderful, wonderful collection. The New York Academy of Medicine, the New York Public Library, the library in Berkeley, whose name I should know but don't, has a very fine collection of cookbooks. The Bancroft Library. The Clements Library at Ann Arbor.
The Cornell Library.
Yes, indeed. The hotel school at Cornell, but because of the hotel school, there are some very nice books down at in San Diego. At the university there, University of California. So there are some great collections in the States. The British Library, the Bibliothèque Nationale in France, the very early books, you have to go quite often to Brussels because the Brussels Bibliothèque Nationale holds the collection of the original Burgundian Empire. Yes. 1400. I know. Okay. More questions. But by all means, start on the Internet, because more and more is available on the Internet, and therefore in your own home. Fine. Thank you. Any more questions? Yes, sorry.
I was curious if you can speak a little bit about the celebrity chef and how that kind of came into being in the 19th century?
Yes. Here I have to say that I hope not arbitrarily, but tried to identify when genre really flourished. And there were celebrity chefs, if one can call it that, chefs who were known names and would have been well known within a small circle long before that. And indeed, in the very first cookbook, Platina, he acknowledges and which is quite remarkable for the time, that the recipes in my book are from my friend Martino of Como, who, it turns out, worked for the Duke of Savoy, I think. But that's before the first... The manuscript dates from about 1460, which is just the dawn of printing. Mm. And then, I mean, you got sort of celebrity chefs wherever they had a master who was financing the whole thing, who had an eye to publicity. And, of course, early on, but still... Food is a power play. Scarpi has a wonderful illustration. He worked for a pope, and during the time he worked for the pope, there was a conclave. And he has a wonderful illustration at the back of his book of the food being put through a hatch. It had to go through past a panel of bishops who tasted it, and inspected the containers for messages and, of course, for poison. And then it went through the hatch. And if you were a rich cardinal, you could influence other cardinals and therefore create your political party if you could afford really good food. And the reason that Charles V... and Taillevent, which is that early manuscript that became a printed cookbook, he wanted to document what was going on at his court, but also to tell other monarchs and the nobility over which he ruled how powerful, influential, and cutting-edge he was. And it's really, I mean, still, people give dinner parties to impress and, you know, for fundraising for Obama, you have Wolfgang Puck. There you are, right, straight, absolutely straight line.
Sure. Thank you, Anne, for this fascinating talk about the history of cookbooks and your new book, The Cookbook Library. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club is adjourned.